The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, over the last few weeks, we've looked at gold. We looked at it for 2 weeks with Ian McCavity. But in the mainline media, David, we're starting to see people outspoken about the need for gold. David, a good example is Steve Forbes. He came out and he said gold can actually save us right now from the situation that we're in.
Well, I think one of the things that Steve Forbes is focusing on is at the core of our economy. If you can't trust the currency, then really what is your reference point in terms of international trade, domestic trade, price stability? You know, we talk about having concerns about inflation or deflation, and we think of those as economic issues when in fact they're really monetary in nature.
Yeah.
It has everything to do with what is happening to your money. And, you know, this is where I think this is a must-read article. It just highlights some of the things that are critical. Today's topic is the gold standard, why we need it, what we should be doing to get it implemented, and the costs that we've endured for many decades without it.
Well, and David, there are some unlikely voices right now in this campaign. You know, over in Europe, Wiedemann, who's the head of Bundesbank, was talking about the need to have some sort of monetary discipline like the gold standard had.
But it was early this year in the Financial Times where Robert Zoellick, who at the time was president of the World Bank, was suggesting we need gold as a part of our international monetary
system.
That
is an unlikely voice, Dave. The World Bank?
Well, and I think what we're seeing is more and more practitioners of finance saying something is wrong with the system and it needs to be addressed at the most foundational and fundamental levels, at the unit of account. When you're dealing with the denomination, the currency itself, that's where you begin to rebuild a financial system on the basis of stability.
Do you think we maybe rest on our laurels just because the dollar is the reserve currency of the world and we're forgetting just how rotten that currency really is?
Oh, we forget it. We forget how exceptionally rotten our currency system is because, you know, again, as we engage in commerce every day, consumed by the here and now, we really don't reflect on the core issue of price stability.
Right.
The changes affecting our dollars are spread over a long enough period of time that it goes unnoticed, particularly by a U.S. audience.
Well, okay, but let's say we're sitting overseas right now and we're making business decisions. We have to buy soybeans from so-and-so and we have to sell oil to so-and-so. What are we going to do? Are we going to continue to hold dollars that are devaluing or are we going to find other ways around that?
Well, this is where you see a greater sensitivity to dollar degradation or dollar decline. There's a little bit more distance from the issue and the changes, which are imperceptible here in the United States, again, because they're spread out over such a long period of time.
You know what that reminds me of?
They're more obvious.
Yeah, what that reminds me of is when you visit family members, okay, maybe once a year at Christmas, and you watch their kids growing up, you see changes that they may not have seen. I mean, it's hard to point it out to them because they've watched it the whole time.
Right. Well, it's always surprising to the outsider. Inflation over a long period of time is, frankly, not just an inconvenience for the consumer, you know, where they're paying higher and higher prices as time goes on, but it's also a source of frustration for the would-be saver or investor. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone looks out on the time horizon and says, you know, someday I'd like to retire. 50,
right.
60, 65, 70, 75. You know, in tomorrow's generation, perhaps it's, you know, we have dreams of retirement in our 80s. But I think what people are frustrated by is, again, the would-be saver or investor, the ability to save and invest is diminished by ever-increasing prices. This is where we see a disconnect, in fact, with many economists who say that inflation in prices is driven by inflation in wages, where people are making more, therefore there's more money that's spent on goods. Goods go up in price because there's a scarcity of goods. The issue for a long time has been that prices are rising, but wage growth has been stagnant.
Well, and David, this is why most people are starting to run out of money before they run out of month. And, you know, they say their cost of living is really not going up, and we're told that actually our standard of living is much better today than it was before, but statistics don't show that.
Right. So you've got an issue here, which, you know, if you want to put it in terms of labor arbitrage, companies, in order to keep their margins healthy, will lower wages, and this isn't, we're not talking about outright pay cuts, but by outsourcing their employees to a lower wage environment, that's called labor arbitrage, mm-hmm. they're basically counterbalancing the inputs that they're not really in control of, commodity prices, healthcare costs, transport and distribution costs, and so they're trying to keep margins sort of in balance, and labor arbitrage has allowed them to maintain margins and continue to deliver shareholder value. But what we've seen is, in the context of globalization, I don't have a problem with this per se, but you do have lower wages in another country, which puts a cap on wages here, even though costs continue to rise.
Well, and David, we've talked about this many times before. This isn't just a monetary issue. It's not an economic issue. It's not some form of academia. This is a justice issue. There's morality involved in this, morality and immorality. And so let's talk a little bit about the justice of money.
Yeah, because, I mean, one of the things, when I just casually mentioned costs continue to rise,
right.
This is not just an accidental issue. There is a causal connection between the way money is managed, and I'm not talking about individually managed, but managed by a central bank,
right.
and the consequence to real goods and services as they're priced in real time in the marketplace.
So, David, on that issue of justice, let's talk about morality and justice.
Well, where you've put forth an effort, I mean, I'm talking about your work effort in a day. A man or woman is worth their wage. That's a principle that we've seen illustrated through history. It's made for successful businesses, and it's certainly, you know, illustrated in some of the great works on ethics. Where you have an effort put forth, there should be an effort rewarded, a just and appropriate compensation. This is one of the reasons why we look at the old child labor laws and all the issues of slavery. There's many issues with slavery, but certainly there is a dehumanizing when someone is not compensated fairly for the effort that they've put in. And so, to varying degrees, you've seen that through history, and it brings us back to that issue of stable prices being critical, because what was a living wage is quickly unlivable as stuff gets more expensive.
Well, and David, I have a question for you. Should a man work a day's labor for a day's wage that's paid by something that somebody can print for free?
Well, and that's an issue, isn't it? Because it doesn't have any intrinsic value. It has an assumed value. It has an associated value. And over a period of time, again, this is by maintaining loose monetary policy, mm-hmm. over a long period of time, there is a gradual repricing of goods and services and an increased need to work more for the old stuff, or even work more for less.
Well,
again,
indeed,
this is what rubs me the wrong way and has me look at this as an issue of justice, because I still show up and work hard. You show up and work hard. The average worker across America shows up and works hard.
And their wife and their family members.
And they're having to work more and more for less and less. And this is not, I think, to be laid at the foot of major corporations, because, again, it's not just a question of outsourcing. It's a question of repricing. And that repricing is a function of what is being done to the money earned. And it's buying less and less through time.
Well, and David, talking about time, okay, we both grew up with the Jetsons, all right, which was to show what technological advances would do for our life. More leisure time, sure, you go to the office, but you don't go to the office long. You've got all these things that are delivered right to your home, and we actually have these technological advances, yet we're working as many hours as we ever have been.
In spite of them. So to say that a different way, in spite of those changes,
right?
Again, with cheaper electronic goods, cheaper cell phones, we still need to work more for the same lifestyle. And again, that's not a problem that you can lay at the feet of greedy company executives or corporate fat cats. It's the more subtle moving of the goalposts by the Federal Reserve System, continually degrading our currency. And the beauty is, it's something that is imperceptible, because the time frame involved is such that you can't observe the change.
Well, you know, David, I watched the football game last night, and the Broncos had a huge comeback. But, you know, it was a good metaphor you used, because if they continue to move the goalpost imperceptibly, and you continue to do that and do that and do that, ultimately you'd never make a touchdown. You'd run and you'd run and you'd run, but you couldn't get to the touchdown. And that seems to be what's happening. We've seen the dollar, just since they closed the gold window back in 1971, lose, what, 90% of its value.
And I think this is where conservatives tend to focus on the issue of justice. You know, is this an issue of just weights and measures? Is the Fed managing our money or mismanaging our money and creating all kinds of issues, whether it's malinvestment, rampant profligacy of financial products on Wall Street, you know, government spending, which is off the charts and uncontrollable? I think for conservatives, there is an issue of justice here and just weights and measures.
But even a liberal who is more concerned with social justice.
Well, exactly. If you look at it from the standpoint of social justice issues, I'd suggest that the wrong place to start is there with a political critique. Political parties argue essentially about whose responsibility it is to care for others.
Right.
And amongst conservatives, it's I care for myself. Amongst liberals, it's I care for everyone, but not necessarily with my money. Your money involved, but I still like
the idea of caring for them. You just got political there.
Well, I understand. I apologize.
You're right. But go back with the idea.
Well, so to simplify, there is a divide between who's responsible for whom. And this is the idea behind empowering government to implement more and more social programs.
Right.
The problem lies in the often neglected issue of money. Mm. Most basically, if your money cannot maintain price stability, the ranks of the government dependent will always grow. Because again, you're dealing with being unable to take care of yourself,
sure,
unable to take care of others. And this is not a rehash of Romney's comment on the 47%. What I'm saying is that government, via the Federal Reserve System, will continue to grow out of necessity as people look at once was a living wage and is no longer so.
Well, and David, this is the fascinating thing, because we're just weeks away from possibly a change in administration or not. But whatever the case is, we've got a debt problem right now that is created by this monetary system the way it stands. And unless that monetary system is thrown out, the difference between an Obama presidency and a Romney presidency is marginal when it comes to money.
Well, I think what we'll find is the commonality exists between, often the criticism is, there's no difference between the Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
The red shirts and the blue shirts.
Right.
Same team, just who's on the field. Individual empowerment and opportunity is gradually being replaced. And it doesn't matter if it's the Republicans or Democrats, but it's being replaced with dependency on the state as the system creates a context in which care of others and care of self is constrained by rising costs.
Right.
You understand? I mean, we more and more have to focus on just meeting our own individual needs. The average family across this country can't be as generous and as concerned about the needs of their neighbor when they're very likely not going to be able to pay their own bills. But this is the issue. We're creating dependency, and this system is being driven not by Republicans or Democrats, but by the Federal Reserve System. This is our central bank who is responsible today for printing money. This is not how money was always managed. But uniquely, the issue with Tea Party and Occupy participants, what they should agree on is the travesty of what government has done to our money. And out of that flow many, many other issues.
Well, and David, what's amazing is this thing is just a self-continuing, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. You know, the more dependency that you create by this wage problem or this inflation problem, the more you have to create more and more and more of it until it finally, you can't feed itself. I've mentioned this before, but when I was a little kid, I was 6 or 7 years old, I had a little Fisher-Price record player, and I had three records, and one or two of them had a story on it. This one had the story of the big oven, and it makes me cold even just thinking about it, but it talked about this man who had this large oven, and everybody was jealous because he had the warmest house in, you know, on the block, and it was the largest house as well. But over time, he continued to feed the oven, and it took more and more wood and more wood until he finally cut the house up one by one, you know, timber by timber, furniture piece by furniture piece, until he had nothing but a cold oven. And the way the story ends, you can hear the wind blowing and the snow. And that is where we're going with the paper dollar.
Well, so whether it's a question of justice in the abstract, or even if it's cast as a social justice issue, the Fed centers in the discussion because of the delegation of responsibility to the Fed for the creation of our money, which was not always the case. You understand, this is a unique phenomenon in U.S. history. It was never to be, according to our founding fathers.
Right.
It's been fought over multiple times. This is the third iteration of a central bank, because the first two were allowed to go away because they determined at different points in U.S. history that we needed something that was better than a managed money system.
Well, and the fascinating thing is the American Revolution, a big part of it was fought over this same issue. You know, look at the Bank of England. They had everyone in debt to them by the time the American Revolution was being fought. So the Patriots knew that this was something they didn't want to repeat.
Well, it's something we should look at. Just in brief, how did we get here? And,
right.
And this is just sort of a synopsis, a brief history 1717, Isaac Newton was brought in by the royals to figure out why their money system was failing. And he figured out that the Money Guild was, in fact, treating the crown unfairly. And what he did in 1717 was put the British on the gold standard, where the money was defined by a specific weight of gold and of silver. So we have the pound sterling. But this is essentially where the definition of the pound and of the sterling came from, silver and gold as a part of the monetary system. There was a number of things that were happening at the time which made not only the gold standard, but the British become one of the most successful enterprises, if you will, or country experiments, if you will, in world history.
Well, didn't they dominate trade? Partially, it was because of the gold standard that they dominated trade.
A couple of factors, yeah. Because one, you had the British naval expansion,
right,
which was, it ended up becoming central to their move into world trade. The currency was easy to like and even easier to trust than other alternatives around the world. So the pound sterling backed by gold and that history, that legacy, made it an easy go-to currency.
But David, like the United States, they also had vast military superiority. I mean, they ruled the ocean at that time.
Right. So dominant trade position, vast military superiority, and gold backing their currency. Mm-hmm. On that basis, London became the world financial center. So what they call the old lady of Threadneedle Street, which is kind of the euphemism for the central bank in Great Britain, the old lady of Threadneedle Street became the most important institution in the 19th century. These are, in fact, traits that the U.S. has come to share in a post-World War II era with, again, this is common to the British-run sterling-dominated system with trade preeminence, trusted currency status, and the like. This is now what the U.S. system reflects. New York is the new London. The Central Bank of America, which is the Federal Reserve,
right,
is the old Lady of Threadneedle Street, just in new garb.
Well, David, you know, you're talking about the United States sort of being that same thing right now. That was partially or mainly because we were on a gold standard when Bretton Woods was put together. And so the Bretton Woods standard did make us trustworthy, like London was back a couple of hundred years ago when they were on a gold standard.
Now, just to clarify, though, because, Kevin, what you just said, we were on the gold standard before Bretton Woods.
Right.
We really weren't.
The exchange standard.
We were on the gold exchange standard,
yeah,
which we'll clarify that in a minute. But so 1717, remember that date. The British adopted it, and Isaac Newton made it happen.
Right.
1860 to 1880, there was really a global revolution in the world of currencies where three-quarters of the globe went on to, on a voluntary basis, went on to the gold standard. And essentially, you had what became a one-world currency. Gold was acknowledged by everyone around the world as the currency of choice. And so world trade during that period of 1860 actually to about 1914, world trade and an expansion of globalization and international cooperation and world peace expanded at a pace and at a rate had never been seen in
world
history.
David, there was price stability back then. I mean, we didn't have hyperinflations in any of the countries that were on this gold standard.
Well, what's interesting, when you look at the U.S. in particular, that period, let's say 100 years, the 19th century, was defined by a variance of about 10% in terms of prices, up or down. Minor inflations, minor deflations, but about a 10% variance for the century. Now, fast forward to the 20th century, and we've subsequently been in the context of rising prices to the tune of about 22 times.
Hmm.
22 times versus 10%. 22 times, you know, we're just looking at a basic list of daily necessities that over the course of the 20th century is up 22-fold compared to a 10% variance in the previous century. Why? And this is where we take for granted. Again, we go back to our earlier comments. This is like the frog being boiled or the lobster being boiled. Inflation over a long period of time is not something that consumers associate with the management of money, but it is, in fact, because of the management, or as we would put it, the mismanagement of money. A 22-fold increase in a basic list of staple goods?
In the 20th century.
It's insane.
But David, almost a dream world for trade partners from 1860 to 1914, because we were on a disciplined staple system, and basically that system meant that everyone got paid, their balance of payments equaled out and balanced out because they had gold. They couldn't just print something. There's a compromise, Dave. Look at 1914. What happened in 1914?
We came off the world gold standard because we went into a world war and no one could finance what they needed in terms of tanks and bombs and guns, airplanes and the like, without an easy money policy. And even the British did this. During the Napoleonic Wars, they came off the gold standard, were off of it for about 20, 25 years, and then came back on because they realized, wait a minute, politicians are gaming the system. Yeah. We are doomed unless we go back to something that disciplines their spending habits, and it starts with one thing. It starts with a limited quantity and a clear definition as to what the unit of money is.
Okay, but you go off the gold standard, let's say for a war or a financial crisis. Yes, that's a compromise. But, like you had mentioned, it can be reinstituted, but it wasn't. Okay, there was a conference in 1922 that changed the whole game.
And this is really where there's some confusion. The Conference of Genoa, the change in the gold standard, what bankers argued for at the Conference of Genoa was a compromise, sort of a half loaf. We will have gold as a part of our money system, but we want dollars and pounds sterling, the paper version, also in the list of acceptable reserve assets.
Well, and once you start counting it as reserve, you can start loaning out on that paper reserve instead of gold reserve. Again, you compound it.
So, in theory, there was a move towards stability, but that compromise of allowing paper currencies to also serve as a reserve asset allowed for there to be some gaming on the part of the Americans and the British. It served their advantage, and the rest of the world, in terms of trade partnership, they were really being taken advantage of.
So in the next decade, you had the Roaring Twenties. You know, you had especially 27, 28, and 29 before the crash. But by 32, 33, the whole thing was falling apart.
So 33, if we start in 1717, fast forward to that 1860 to 1914 period, 1922 is a key significant date. 1933 is where, here in the United States, we had the convertibility of gold and paper money suspended. And that was just on a domestic basis. We were still converting dollars for gold with our international trade partners.
Right.
But because it was made illegal for gold to be owned here in the United States, convertibility was only external, could not be done internal. It was illegal to hold and trade for U.S. persons.
And shouldn't it be brought out why? Okay, when you have a standard system where anyone can get gold in their hand, or let's say a $20 bill, which was the standard here in America, you could have a 1 ounce gold coin or a $20 bill. Well, if they start printing too much money, it's a self-correcting system, David, because people will say, well, here's your 20, give me my gold. They had to close that down at least domestically in 33.
You know, that period, 33 to 37, was probably the greatest shift in our country of any period before or since, from an economic standpoint and even from a social standpoint, because what happened there, Kevin, was the government took control of the money printing via the Fed. The Fed had been created in 1913, but really only given the keys to the kingdom in a post-gold era, which was after 1933.
Right.
Now, here's what's interesting. It was from this point forward that government spending began to replace private spending in terms of charities and sort of taking care of the common good.
Hmm.
Look at the crisis of the 1930s.
Tendency you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And our running assumption today is that government takes care of the needy. We don't. And of course, there are generous people who will share a part of their wealth. And you see that with foundations. You see that with individuals. You see that in religious communities where it's almost a given. 10% of my... Okay, that's an exception.
Hmm.
But what took place was a cultural shift where government said, we have an alphabet soup list of organizations which will do this and that and the other. We don't have the money to pay for it unless we have control of the money supply. Now we control the money supply.
And we'll print it.
And we have money to pay for it.
Yeah.
So we can pay for any government program heretofore. That was a major shift. And granted, we needed the jobs. We needed the jobs in that period of time. But what we didn't need is the government to fill what was a temporary vacuum in terms of a, call it a social generosity, where we took care of our neighbor took care of us. I mean, the stories during the 1930s are very common for people who didn't have food. Families shared amongst themselves.
Right.
Communities, if you had an extra chicken, you shared with your neighbor. If somebody was traveling through on their way to looking for a good job prospect on the other coast, you let them stay with you. You fed them overnight. You gave them work for a week. That would never happen today, in part because we have ingrained in us that government takes care of those issues, we don't.
Well, that's why some of the people that we talk to, David, in their 80s and 90s still look back at that time as the best, worst time.
Well, and I think, you know, just fast forwarding from 33 to 1944, we already said that the gold exchange standard included fiat currencies.
Right, right.
And did not tie us directly to 100% gold backing. 1944, that's what we carried with us into the Bretton Woods Agreement, where we tied every world currency to the U.S. dollar, and implicit in that was the dollar had sufficient gold backing to cover all external liabilities.
Well, and all the foreign governments that had dollars could change it any time they wanted to gold.
Right. So post-World War II, the money system focused on paper, but with a dollar orientation. Again, the dollar orientation, and the given in the equation was our 8,000 tons of gold, which served as a reserve, the largest reserve in the world. So but by proxy, there was some association to gold.
And we kept printing, though. And Jacques Roof wrote a book called The Monetary Sin of the West that basically warned ahead of time that this was not going to last.
Right. So the gold pool was broken, the official pricing there in the early 70s. Jacques Roof anticipated that in the early 60s. And all of a sudden, 1971 rolls around, and international convertibility. Remember, we talked about domestic convertibility, where it was illegal for someone in the U.S. to own gold. Well, international convertibility was suspended. We would not pay our debts in gold ounces anymore. It was just in paper dollars, which we could create with basically a 3-cent cost basis. $1 costs us 3 cents to create, and for that we get 97 cents of purchasing power for free. And frankly, our foreign creditors didn't like that. They wanted the real stuff, not the stuff that we could create virtually out of nothing.
Well, and enter Richard Nixon, who had to do what he had to do, he said, but just temporarily, and that's to close the gold window completely.
Since then, we've been living with a fiat system. Fiat meaning a currency system that has nothing backing it except the integrity of bankers. Now, that's not to impugn the integrity of bankers. It is just to say that the system as it is constructed will tend to be inflationary. And there is a huge advantage given to us, the U.S., as there was a huge advantage to the British before us. The advantage today is ours. The world has become to some degree dollarized,
right,
just as the world before, you know, again, sort of up until about the 1920s or 30s, was really defined by the pound sterling and the British trade system, with London being the financial hub of the world. That has now fallen to us. It's not something that we necessarily get to keep. We may keep, we're likely to keep it, but on what basis? Are we giving the world a reason to have confidence in our system? Because again, this is why we've gone through the history a little bit. There was a reason why the British were given the benefit of the doubt. It wasn't because everyone thought the Queen was pretty. It was because they had confidence in gold. They had confidence in gold. It was something that they knew could not be messed around with. And so if you're trading through London, if you're trading with an international firm, trade settlement could occur in a currency that you had confidence in. We have taken advantage of the trust of the world, who has put confidence in the dollar, and yet we've been degrading the dollar over the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years. We've been in a steady decline with fits and starts of more radical devaluation, and this is where our foreign creditors have reason to be concerned.
Well, and David, while the dollar is still the reserve currency, while the world is still on a dollarized system, shouldn't this be the time before collapse that we should be looking at some sort of salvation for the dollar? Try to stay in that position, but with a more rational backing.
This brings us full circle to Steve Forbes' article titled Gold Can Save Us from Disaster, because one of the disasters that we have as a country is losing reserve currency status, which we will do because money is nothing more than a confidence game, and people can have confidence in it or they can lose confidence in that unit of measure. And the question is, why would they have confidence in the dollar today? It is an interesting large liquidity pool, but in terms of credit, in terms of reliability, we have shown our hand to be very unreliable and to actually be a very bad credit. What we would suggest, along with Forbes, along with Lewis Lehrman, along with Robert Zoellick, along with a growing host of Wall Street luminaries and financiers, is that we need stability at the core of our financial system. And if we don't move there very quickly, the financial system as we know it and the monetary system of the world will be upended violently.
Well, and David, you mentioned Lewis Lehrman, and we've mentioned on this program many times that our office goes through various books and then gets together, discusses it. We write papers on it. There's a number of things that we do to really absorb the book. But Lewis Lehrman has written a book that I think you'd like to recommend at this point.
It's called The True Gold Standard, a monetary reform plan without official reserve currencies. And what this is literally 100 pages or less of a step sequence, summary of the monetary reform plan, why we need a true gold standard, why it needs to be 100% gold, not the gold exchange standard of the past, right, where games could continue to be played. And there was the appearance of the comfort of gold backing the currency, but in fact, the advantage given to the banking community to play games and ultimately cater to political corruption. I mean, let's put it in very honest and very simple terms. When you have an unlimited amount of money, you get to spend an unlimited amount of money on various constituency groups. We have a budget today which reflects a high degree of political corruption, which is only possible given an unlimited amount of money.
It reminds me of keeping your credit card for just emergencies, and then everything's an emergency.
Everything's an emergency.
Yeah.
So you have to define limits, and that's not done voluntarily, not by the banking community. Never met a dollar they didn't want to lend out, and particularly when you can create those dollars out of nothing and lend them out and collect interest on them.
Right.
And again, that's the system. I appreciate the system. It's a system that has worked, but it's a system that works to the advantage of some and actually hurts many others. So again, if you're looking at this from the standpoint of justice, if you're looking at it from the standpoint of social justice, frankly, if you want to see the world and globalization expand the way we did during 1860 to 1914 period, one of the fundamental things you need is a trustworthy currency. Mm-hmm. The dollar has been that trustworthy currency, and people are losing confidence and losing trust in it.
Okay, so David, all that's nice. We talk about idealistically we could be on a gold standard, but really, what should we do now?
Well, I mean, if you want to quote John Maynard Keynes or even look at sort of someone on the opposite end of the spectrum, Henry Hazlitt, whether it was from Bretton Woods to world inflation or economics in one lesson, Hazlitt said it decades ago, the answer is simple. We must stop inflating. And the most reliable, tested means of tying the hands of politicians and their back pocket central bankers is to return to 100% gold-backed currency. John Maynard Keynes said this in 1922, interestingly, about the time of the Genoa Conference. If the gold standard could be reintroduced, we all believe that the reform would promote trade and production like nothing else, but also stimulate international credit and transfer of capital to the places where they're most useful. One of the greatest elements of uncertainty would be suppressed. We would simply encourage you to invest a half a day's time into reading the true gold standard, understand what is involved in a monetary reform plan, and a step-by-step as to how to get it implemented. Because, again, an idea that just a few years ago would have been considered by most in the mainstream to be crackpot, utterly unrealistic and frankly undesirable, you see a growing number of Wall Street practitioners who say, we're okay with discipline. We're okay with the rule of law. We're okay with predictability. This is John Taylor's idea that Fed policy needs to be less discretionary and much more patterned and predictable.
Right.
There is a need for discipline, which we have not had since 71, since 44, since 33, since 22. To varying degrees, we've been losing and washing away what was a necessary discipline in the equation. But this is not a crackpot idea. This is something that the world central bankers, as recently as the 1960s, were discussing. You know, the Conference of Genoa, we discussed. There was a conference in Bologna in 1967, and they were trying to figure out what gold should be priced at as a part of the world monetary system. There was a running assumption, and this is Triffin, this is Mundell, this is all of the guys who are read by your PhD economists today, and they assumed that it was still a part of the conversation. Something changed in 71, but we need to go back in history and reenact what was the most stable, what in fact set the precedent for the greatest growth in world history, unprecedented growth. 19th and 20th century has redefined global growth, and it had everything to do with the gold standard.
Well, and could we be seeing a replay of this dialogue a little early maybe, but from Wiedemann and Zolick and Grant and like you said, Steve Forbes. These guys back in the 60s saw the train light coming back through the tunnel, and they knew the gold standard wasn't going to last. They were already talking about making it sound again. Now, here's my question, though. There are always vested interests, Dave. There are a lot of people who will say, oh, well, there's not enough gold in the world to do this, or one country a better advantage than another country. Now, these vested interests don't want to see a gold standard because they're having their cake and they're eating it too. So Are we in a period of time right now where we could see this, or should we just be preparing for the time when the vested interests lose face?
Kevin, the vested interests you're talking about, whether it's at the Fed or politicians today who like to spend more than they bring in, these are vested interests that have to be addressed, and the system does not accommodate the gold standard today because the vested interests don't want anything other than the status quo.
But there are paradigm turning points. You've had us read the book from Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's all about a scientific paradigm that's held tightly for sometimes 100 years, and then all of a sudden, boom, it's busted.
And what happens in that process is problems begin to accumulate that are not addressed by the governing school of thought, and ultimately the problems get to be sort of a critical mass.
Where, like the sun, okay, things do not revolve around the Earth in the solar system. They revolve around the sun. That paradigm finally had to be broken.
Exactly. And the old science became a radically new science.
Right.
The old money management system that we have via central bank and the Fed will become a new system. We believe it's possible. Now, it seems very unlikely today, but we don't know who our leadership is tomorrow. We don't know what ideas they will prize. And this is where we would remind them of justice issues. We would remind them of the value of the individual. A worker is worth his wage. And for a bank, a central bank, to degrade the wage which a worker is worth is a way of dehumanizing the general population and creating a world full of dependents. There is a moral issue here. There is something that has to be addressed, and it's something that we think may be addressed over the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, David, one of the things that we see through history is that history is usually changed by a minority, not a majority viewpoint, when those paradigms change. And, you know, this book, The True Gold Standard by Lehrman, everyone listening to the program should read this book, because actually, if not us, then who will bring this change about?
If we were to achieve going back to the true gold standard, then individuals wouldn't need to be on their own personal gold standard. The system would have done that for you.
Right.
As it is, you do need it. And as it is, we are needed as a company. There could be a future date, if we're successful, where we're not as necessary.
Well, you know, I think about the time that we actually started this company, or your dad did, back in 1972. He was doing that to put people on a personal gold standard.
We came off in 71. We started the business in 72 because the need was obvious. We would relish the day, and this may sound very strange, but we would relish the day when we're no longer needed.
But until that time, Dave, wouldn't you say it's safe to say you really want to stay on your own personal gold standard?
Oh, I think it's absolutely necessary.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.